Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anna Mateo, and Steve Ember. But first, this report.
For many people who seek higher education in the United States, the common study period of 2 to 4 years is not enough. Luckily, graduate degree programs permit students to continue their education and become even more skilled in a given field. The highest level of education offered by an American college or university is a doctoral degree, or PhD, in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM fields. It takes about 5 years of additional study to earn a PhD. In humanities fields, like history or language, receiving a doctoral degree takes an average of 7 years. Doctoral degree programs are difficult and can be costly, but in the past they have been a path to a well-paying, meaningful career. A new study, however, finds that the number of people seeking PhDs has decreased. Experts say the structure of the American higher education system could be the cause.
Every year, the National Science Foundation, the U.S. Education Department, and several other groups release a study on the number of research degrees earned in the U.S. The most recent study showed that the number of doctoral degrees fell to 54,664 in 2017 from 54,862 the year before. This may only be a 1% decrease. But the authors of the study expressed concern over what the decrease may mean for the future. Other nations, recognizing the contributions doctorate recipients make to economies and cultures, are investing heavily in doctoral education, they wrote. The world's brightest students, including U.S. citizens, may go elsewhere for the doctoral degree, and they may begin careers elsewhere as well. Some experts argue that the latest information does not show important changes in U.S. higher education. Robert Townsend is the director of the offices of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Washington, D.C. He said he would want to see several years of decreases before raising major concerns. Although the overall number of doctoral degrees decreased, he noted that is mainly because of differences in STEM fields and the humanities. In fact, the number of STEM PhDs increased. And as a growing number of people seek graduate degrees, many more companies are favoring those people for employment.
Yet, Townsend noted that the path most doctoral degree holders take once they complete their education is changing. In the past, most doctoral students entered postdoctoral positions. In these positions, they would usually do research in their fields while also teaching. This has long been the first step toward being chosen for a tenured position, one in which a college or university offers a lifetime position for teaching and research. Townsend said, in the case of the humanities, this has changed over the last 30 years. there has been a move away from the humanities fields towards STEM fields because of the belief that they lead to better paying jobs. As a result, colleges and universities are employing fewer humanities professors. This can lead to more students reconsidering the long and costly road to a humanities PhD, Townsend added. And without a graduate degree, it may be harder for humanities students to demonstrate their abilities to employers outside of higher education. We need to be doing a better job of helping our students understand that, as they're getting a PhD, they're not necessarily going to go into a career that will look like that of the person that's teaching them, he told VOA. Most colleges and universities cover a large part of the costs for students seeking STEM doctorates. But that does not mean there is less risk involved in investing so much time in your education, said John Walsh. Walsh is a professor of public policy at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. He added that there are also some signs that STEM PhDs may be losing their appeal, too.
Walsh co-authored a study released in December on the amount of time scientists worked on publishing academic research. It examined the work of over 100,000 scientists who published studies between 1900 and 2015. The study found that on average, it took about 35 years for half of a group of scientists in the 1960s to reach a point where they were no longer publishing academic research. By comparison, in the 2010s, it took an average of 5 years for half of a group of scientists to stop publishing. The reason, Walsh said, was that many people are leaving research positions at colleges and universities. It is similar to the problem facing those in the humanities, said Walsh. There are fewer chances for growth. He noted that many research projects are much larger than they were in the past. Yet these projects are still usually only led by one researcher, usually a tenured professor, and they are the ones who get the most recognition for the work. The many postdoctoral researchers who help with these larger projects are highly skilled, Walsh said. However, they are less able to progress in their careers because they receive less attention. And their positions often only last for a few years. This means that they may have to move from project to project, or even leave higher education completely. We don't have good ways for recognizing people like that in universities, said Walsh. We don't have good ways of rewarding people who are very good at those supporting roles that might be very critical for the success of the project. There have always been well-paying jobs for people with STEM PhDs in private industry, he added. But failing to create special positions for researchers in higher education may push students away from seeking PhDs in the first place. And having fewer academic researchers will harm the amount of important scientific discoveries coming from the United States. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Like many languages, English uses animals in many of its expressions. And there are thousands of kinds of animals. So when we talk about them, we put them into different groups. Take, for example, pack animals. One kind is an animal used to carry packs or heavy loads. Donkeys and mules are pack animals. We sometimes call these animals beasts of burden because they help to ease the burden of humans. Another type of pack animals are the ones that live and hunt in a group, or pack. These include gray wolves and dolphins, just to name a couple.
Running with a pack has many benefits. When animals live in a pack, they work together. There is strength and safety in numbers. If you run with a pack, you can depend on others in your group. And there is always someone who has your back or is ready to fight for you. We can describe people the same way. Some like to run with a pack. They like to surround themselves with like-minded people. People can run with a pack that likes the same music, has the same politics, or enjoys the same activities. It is easy to hang out with people who generally agree with you. It is comfortable, maybe a little too comfortable.
This can lead to a pack mentality, a situation where everyone thinks the same. After time, you could become resistant to ever disagreeing, fearful of losing your place in the pack. We also call this groupthink. This is a situation where members of a group feel pressure to always agree. Groupthink results in failures to think critically about an issue, situation, or decision. Groupthink or pack mentality can even be dangerous. People caught up in a pack mentality do not think for themselves and can make bad decisions. For example, teenagers might start hanging out with other teens who do drugs or commit crimes. So parents often try to control which pack their child runs with. With both animals and people, there is usually a leader of the pack. In our human pack, the leader is the one who calls the shots. They make the decisions for the group. Some people, however, have no desire to run with a pack. They might be ahead of the pack and are more forward-thinking. They do not want to go along with what everyone else is doing. Maybe they are just faster. Or perhaps they simply enjoy the life of a lone wolf. As a lone wolf, you solve problems by yourself. You do not ask for help when making decisions. You are free from pleasing a group. However, you might not have many friends. After all, everything has a cost.
Now, we finish our show with yet another type of pack animal, the pack rat. This is a small rodent of Western North America. Pack rats have large cheek pouches where they store food and other things. These pouches can fill up fast. In the human world, pack rats are people who keep things that they do not need. They store them not in their cheeks, but in their homes, garages, and other storage places. A pack rat often says things like, "I can't throw it out. I might need it someday." When pack rats collect too much stuff and it interferes with their life, they have become a hoarder. Hoarders have a difficult time throwing anything away. So, they usually find themselves surrounded by stuff, sometimes even buried under it.
However, sometimes it pays to be a pack rat, or at least to know one. One day, you just may need something they have collected. A 40-year-old newspaper, a bicycle wheel, or a cowbell. One look in a pack rat's basement or garage, and you just might find what you need. And that's Words and Their Stories.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal, except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory. Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory. But slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process. Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in Southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the Northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most Southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor. In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On election day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme. She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said, if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.